that's going to be next year, right? Mm-hmm. That's what's it called again? The Queen Suite, is it?
Well, it is whatever the name they put it, but it was one that he wrote for the Queen.
Right.
And it's, you said it's property of Buckingham Palace or whatever.
I think what is it? I think the story is that the Queen met Count Basie. Is it Count Basie?
No, Duke Ellington.
Duke Ellington. In Leeds.
In Leeds,
of all places.
That's right.
I don't know where or what app, presume some gala or concert. And they struck up a conversation and apparently they got on quite well. And then when he went back, he wrote a suite and recorded it, but they only ever pressed one copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent it to the Queen. And as far as I know, from a little Google search I did, it now resides with, whether it's at Buckingham Palace or, you know, she had it. And obviously now Charles will have it. And he only wrote it for her.
Really?
I mean, it has been recorded since, Steve was saying, and we can get the parts. But...
Well, in that stream, which I checked out further down on your emails, is that there was a name of someone mentioned that with the Union Big Band, a Union Orchestra.
Yeah, something like that.
That actually recorded it. So Steve said himself, so there must be some parts knocking around.
Yeah, there will be some parts. So that would be good for us to do next year. Off the back of the album, but this year's quite busy anyway, because what have we got coming? You're doing Hull on Thursday, aren't you?
Yeah, Thursday night.
How's that coming along? Are you ready?
Yeah, I think we are ready, yeah. I'm really looking forward to this this Thursday. It's good.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased with the way it's coming together, especially this one, because I want it to be good for Rob, who's one of the members, you know.
Yeah.
And it's the first one for us as well. And importantly, there's a youth jazz orchestra, you know, supporting us.
Oh, good.
Sort of doing a spot in the first half, which is...
Nice. Which so they're playing first and then DJ will play second.
And then we're following on.
That'll be good for Rob, for Rob's students.
Well, it's Rob's students, I presume. It's Rob directing.
Yeah, and probably Mike Brown knows some of those kids as well.
I think he will do, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be good. I'm sorry I can't make it, but, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry the mic's not in because I see he's not in the trumpet section, so he must have something else on.
Okay. But that'll be a good one. And then it's the biggie is the Earl on 21st of April.
21st of April, yep.
All right.
A Sunday afternoon. Perfect.
Yeah.
So I rather hope that...
How many gigs do you think we've done at the Earl over the years?
Oh, good Lord. We did our first concert in there and they've been mostly annual. You know, I think we only sort of missed one for COVID.
Right.
But we started in 75.
Yeah, so underneath? I remember going as a kid, like a really young kid, and it was like, I think it was at the back near the car park, and it was underneath, and it had these metal columns.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have a clear view of the band, you were like looking around a column. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And we used to do a jazz club on a Sunday lunchtime, once a month.
That's what
and that was in what they referred to as a Concord suite,
that's it, yeah.
downstairs. With easy access through the fire doors, I remember. Yeah. And the fire escape, the same famous fire escape was there where we had the lovely photograph taken of the band.
So that photograph of the first album is this fire escape to
from
the Earl of Doncaster Hotel.
Yeah. Which, of course, doesn't exist now because they've extended the car park.
So there is really a massive history between the Earl of Doncaster and Doncaster Youth Jazz Association, Doncaster Jazz Orchestra, and now Doncaster Jazz Alumni.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It certainly is. And through the good thoughts and the feelings of goodwill that the manager had, the owner,
Graham
Roden, and he was really very good. He initially didn't charge us at all, but I think his underling, his manager, decided at one time that they ought to charge us something. Yeah. But they've been really very generous, and we're delighted to still be doing concerts at the Earl.
It is good.
Because it really is a good venue.
It is. Graham was always supportive. Do you remember when it was my generation playing years later, we did those dance band gigs?
Oh, that's right.
Remember those? We only did a few of them.
Friday nights.
We probably did, half a dozen. Mm. And what he wanted to do was like get ballroom dancing going again.
But
and it is a ballroom, essentially, where we always play upstairs. And I remember I was probably about 15, 16. That was like our first foray into pro gigs where we, because we got paid. I mean, it might have been 20 quid or something, but you know, to someone who's a teenager in the 90s, that was a lot of money. Well, it was decent money to play.
It was good. It wasn't every week. It was a Friday night, once a month. It was dance night.
And
that was wonderful. And Graham Roden, bless him, on occasions he would sit in on sound.
He was
very good in that, and he so wanted to do it and to pay tribute. And we've done various big band engagements like that, particularly to sort of celebrate, VE Day and various other things that have happened in history. And
do you remember when, I think it was at the Civic Theatre, and you dressed up as Glenn Miller? And everyone was in army. I don't think I was on that gig. I've just seen pictures of it. I don't think I was there.
No, you weren't on that. No,
but everyone was dressed up in proper army apparel.
Yeah,
and you were dressed up as Glenn Miller with the glasses and everything.
That's right. We were loaned some instruments from I think it's Wellington Barracks. In Bulby.
Right.
And I'd already got a uniform for my formative world.
Yeah.
So we did that. And we also did that at the Earl for Graham Roden. I think we did the first one there.
That was a VE Day celebration.
But the important thing is, you talked about your foray into that, you know, as a younger player, is that it was really good training.
Yeah.
And for the actual pieces you played, because sometimes there was quite a lot of sight reading. You had a chance to sort of test your sight reading, on the spot there. And there's a discipline in there in sort of keeping quickly between the two pieces.
Mm.
So there was no time to sort of to hang around. You had to be quick from one piece to another.
Yeah.
So it was...
I remember, was it Jimmy Lally stuff?
Jimmy Lally, that was the famous name. These
arrangements. Obviously, usually when we played in your bands, you'd have your music and it just looked like any other music, probably 2, 3, maybe 4 pages long. But these were kind of like, what do you call them? Medleys.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have maybe 5, 6, 7 songs in one piece of music, but they would always repeat and you would always have a different part to play on the second line, on the second way through. So you'd have, and it was really, it was looked like piano, you know, like when pianists play, you've got your left hand and your right hand. So you've got two staves running concurrently. So you'd have to learn to jump down 2 staves instead of 1, like you would in a normal piece of music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I remember always messing that up or just finding it difficult. The second thing that was difficult was you never got a rest on your chops.
No.
So it was really good training for your kind of, your gig. Stamina, for brass and woodwind. Because obviously brass suffer more, you know, with problems with embouchure when you're playing than woodwind do. But I remember thinking, you'd be playing and you think, oh, please, I just need a bar off, just one bar, and then you'd be into the next tune. And also, because we had to put loads of vibrato on, because we were trying to emulate that
particular period,
that sound, we would all be like, you know, putting massive vibrato on, which I think probably makes it harder to keep your chops in check.
And I can remember sometimes when they would all exaggerate that.
I think we're all guilty of doing it too much.
But the concept of those particular parts was it was always an intro. I would have to sort of say to all of them that those new to it is intro, top and bottom line, and then modulation. You know, you're going to change the key at the end.
Yeah.
And more often, certainly the less experienced players, we would get to the, we'd go to the top and bottom line, as you've quite rightly said, and then get to the, just before the modulation, we would resolve into something sensible and stop there. Because the changes of key were sometimes monumental and was a real challenge to all players.
Yeah.
And so we would do that. But as we got better, we brought in the changes of key because we wanted
That's
to do the piece properly.
For kids, is remembering the key. I still forget keys now.
We're happy times.
All the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember those. That was good times. I felt like we were really active in that period. And then we got the Jazz Centre. And so before there was the Jazz Centre, it was Northcliff. No, it wasn't. It was Wheatley Hills Middle School, was it?
No, it first started at the the first group, basically, at the Music Centre in Wathup-on-the-Dearne.
Right, or Wathup-on-Dearne,
or, yeah, as you or whatever you'd like to say, as yeah. I used to sometimes say, yeah. But, yeah, at Wath Grammar School, as right. As was then, because I was first employed in the old West Riding of Yorkshire.
What was that school called? Is it on a certain road?
Well, it was. I can't remember the road now, but it was Wath Grammar School at that time.
Did you ever rehearse at a place named after a road or a street or something? I seem to remember.
Oh, no, you might be referring to Schofield Street.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's it. From there, a good man who could see the scene that we were having some slight difficulties in the music service because small at that time, sort of seven piece learner jazz band was becoming quite popular. Right. And quite a lot of the youngsters want to, if they couldn't play in it, they wanted to come and listen to it. So it was yeah. having an adverse effect on some of the other important ensembles, you know, within the system.
What you mean they didn't want to go to them and they wanted to come to your jazz
band?
Well,
they were actually coming to our rehearsal when they should have been going along to the orchestra okay. or to another group. But we sorted that because a certain gentleman named Keith Jowett,
yeah.
My partner in crime at that early stage,
yeah.
He was head of Don Valley Further Education.
Right.
And he said that he could find me a room. And I said, but can you find me a room with a piano?
Mm.
And he said, oh, I can get a piano. And he said, I've got two rooms too. And we could probably have a younger band in one room. And,
yeah.
So he provided a situation.
Which yeah, is, yeah.
It was the Schofield Street Further Education Centre in Mexborough.
Right. I think that's the one I remember.
Yeah. Well, you'll probably remember
being... We used to go there on a Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoons. Yeah. Yes.
That's one of my earliest memories. And I must have been, I don't know, three.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe younger.
Yeah, I think you were there. Well, when I first started there, you were almost there, but it was your mother that was carrying you at the time. Because right. she's in the first photograph we had sort of taken of, you know, the music centre there.
Right.
But yes, yeah, happy times.
Yeah. So then from there, you went to Northcliffe when you got the job at Northcliffe?
That's right. Well, I went through sort of teacher training at Bretton Hall and then sort of was asked if I'd like to apply for the job at Northcliffe School.
Okay.
It was a school that I was actually visiting as a right. peripatetic brass teacher.
So they knew it already.
But I knew it pretty well already and the sort of students. But that I was traditionally only having 1 hour there. And I was really keen to get in there for a week at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the position then. I took up a position at Northcliffe School.
Yeah.
And
that's when it really started, when Dijar really started kicking off, isn't it?
I think it did then because we were able to get youngsters that came from, certainly from Conisbrough and some of the members that were coming with me to the music service, you know, as well.
Right. Grammar. Right.
So they would come, they would join us on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
And sometimes they were transported if they were having difficulty. But it was at that time, interestingly, that, you know, over the other side of the Don, that the schools in Doncaster got to know a little bit about this. So some of the enterprising and ambitious sort of students felt that they would like to be part of it. So the likes of Mr. Jonty Stockdale comes to mind, and Russell Cook and others, and Andy Vinter. But very, very, very happy times.
And they would have got, back in the day, they would have probably got on two buses to get there. I mean, I remember going, obviously not then, much later than that, but I used to have to get two buses and then walk up that massive hill. But you didn't think anything of it. Like drummers would, Jez would do that with his drum kit. You would get on two buses, then we'd, you know, that massive hill.
Such
and
a
now
shame.
It's a whole different it's like thing. The kids rock up and the drum kit's there ready for them because someone's set it up. You know, it's a different world, isn't it? Such a different world now.
But it is now.
You know, but it was... I remember Northcliffe because it had those quadrangles and I remember thinking, this is a really cool school because you had these quads and there were like rabbits jumping around freely in the quads and you might have some... like a little plantation or an allotment or whatever, and then over here there'd be a playground or a little park for the kids. It was cool. I really liked Northcliffe. It was a massive school, wasn't it?
It was a lovely place. I really enjoyed the times I spent there. But you just mentioned the wildlife. Yeah. I ought to mention that you probably didn't realise that there was a biology department was above the, my music class.
Oh, they were using upstairs. The rabbits?
No, they had their own sort of animals in the actual, which were breeding.
Right.
And often some of my students be absolutely amazed or worried or laughing at the fact that, Mr. Ellis, look, there's a mouse, and there was a mouse that came regularly. Yeah. That used to run up the door, over the handle, yeah. the door handle, and down again, much to the amusement and entertainment of the yeah. students.
But again, back then, that was just, you know, you didn't worry about mice.
Yeah,
back
it was
then.
All part of life's rich tapestry yeah. at that time. Yeah.
And there was also, I remember, so there was that the big hall where there was the stage where you used to do rehearsals in the evening, mm-hmm. but there was another part to it, and it was like, I don't know if it was the old part or the new part, where there was another stage and almost like an even bigger hall. Do you know what I mean? Like there were two.
Oh, yes, you're right.
In a different part of the school.
That's right.
The, I don't know. Yeah, the north maybe. But.
There was a hall on the original part of the school, which yeah. the side of the music department yeah. at that time.
Yeah.
Which we did most of our.
Was that the old part then?
That was the old yeah. part, yes. But the new hall over on the other side, near the office side,
yeah.
admin part of the school, that was a lovely room as well. And that was basically the room where we recorded our first album day, in 78. And that was Die Jar.
And that's the one with the photo of
that's the one
Earl.
With the photograph. And that was right. Die Jar, North, Die Jar at Northcliffe.
Yeah.
As I say, that was our first recording. Our first
Someone told album. Me recently that they saw that album on eBay for £85.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I'd have to go and find some more.
Because you've got some still left, haven't you?
I still have a handful, yes. Yes. But
you can make a bob or two there, Dad.
I'm not sure about that. That's
so I forget who told me. It might have been Sylvain, because Sylvain wanted to get one, didn't he? I think you took him when we went to France.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure someone said they'd seen one for £85 on eBay. I was like, what? Because I've got one. It's not mine. It's Keith Alderson's. He lent it to. I need to give it him back. But it still says Fox's Music, and I think it's like
$2.99. On the price label.
Yeah, I think it's $2.99 or $3.99 or something.
Oh, God, yes.
But yeah,
it's $2.99. You're right.
Is it $2.99?
That was really good. So
happy
memories.
That was in 78.
From then we were recording. Our albums were on cassette. Yeah, and Life Has Changed.
I remember those
CDs, and now I believe CDs.
Now we've come back full circle.
Pardon?
Because we've just done a vinyl album.
Oh, yeah, that's yeah, certainly have, and that's and what a great pleasure that was.
Yeah. We'll talk about that, I think, in another episode, because I think we need to dedicate a full episode to the album,
really?
To 50 years. Yeah, because it's a big story, I think.
Yeah,
but just going back to, like, Die Jar back in the day,
mm-hmm.
what do you think are... Have you got any, like, standout memories over the last 50... Well, it's 52 years now.
Oh, well,
or 51 years. Of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Music,
there are so many obviously happy
yeah.
memories and high points. Even in the earlier day, I know
yeah.
the more recent ones we can probably talk about in another time.
Mm.
But it was the building of that and the realization that the youngsters themselves were getting so much fun and enjoyment out of playing and learning, and they really did want to learn and. I can remember starting an LP library, vinyls then,
yeah.
and we had racks and racks of libraries. But I always had a good idea of who was really taking it seriously by those that were queuing up after each rehearsal to bring back one LP that they'd listen
yeah.
to take another,
yeah.
and they would sign them in and sign them out, and it's. Some of those people, they did it all the time, you know,
yeah.
and not naming any, because there were quite a lot.
Well, I think it's probably obvious who mm-hmm. those people are, because they've gone on to do some special things. But, like, yeah, we won't name names because we'll definitely leave people out, and then that's not fair. But let's just say there's been a lot of people over the last 51 years that mm-hmm. have benefited from all those bands and all those schools mm-hmm. and the Earl and everything else to go on to have... like successful careers yeah. in music. But also I think there's like there's a lot of people that have just gone on to enjoy music, you know.
Like, it's important for you to say that.
Yeah, because I think that's, it's easy to celebrate, yeah, the guys that went on to become pros and have played with this person and played with that person. All that's great, obviously, but there's still loads of people. I still see people now who were in it, you know, round about roughly the time that I was in it, or even before, or even afterwards, who are maybe not pro players, might not even be semi-pro or teaching, but they're playing still. But they have an appreciation for playing in a band, jazz music to a certain degree, and they all have happy memories of like working hard as a team, trying to get stuff right. There's loads of funny stories, and there's been relationships, there's been children born out of Tighty Char, you know. That's the probably the biggest, you know, success, you know, bit of success you could have if you look at it that way. It's actually created humans in one sense, because people have got together through music.
Like you say, quite importantly, not all of them professional or even semi-professional, but do it for an enjoyment, a hobby or whatever. I mean, as I say, a good percentage of our organisation over the years have had totally unrelated jobs, you know, from solicitors to teachers, you know, to whole gambit, I think. And it's that's important that they do. And some of those still retain... Yeah. A very high level of proficiency, as we know now, because we've got some of those people still in the
band.
The group.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
or they're in the concert band, or, you know, they're playing around town and around the UK, even though they've got a proper job, and they're still doing it at a professional level as well on the side, which is brilliant. You know?
Well, as we say, they got that proper job, as you and I often talk about, because they are the people that some of them are quite professional in their different worlds.
Yeah, yeah.
But are not travelling the length and breadth of the country on motorways throughout the night to gigs.
No, they
don't. To make ends meet.
Living the dream, Dad.
Or as you say, put food on the table. Pardon?
I'm living the dream.
Still dreaming.
Yeah,
no.
Still dreaming.
but how well you do it, because... it's not easy, but
fun though.
Aye?
It's fun. That's why we do it. That's why all musicians do it, because it's fun.
Yeah. I can see that at rehearsals.
But we got that from being in your bands as kids. That's where it started. It's your fault. it's your fault. We're all tired, poor, late nights.
You can blame all that on me, but the talent that those people have, many with natural talent, but many with
I'm going to have to stop you there.
I know you're going to stop me there, but I'm saying that yes, there
There's
are
no
people
such
with natural
thing
talent.
As natural talent.
Pardon?
There's no such thing.
No, I know you're going to tell me that they work hard at what they achieve.
That's my belief. That's my belief. Well, you have a different take on it, don't you? I mean, you've seen thousands of kids on instruments, so you're probably far better, you know, versed at whether or not there's talent, natural ability or not. But I would say that it's the environment plus a certain mindset plus things like Tighty Char and the ability to do music on a rig. I mean, when I was in Tighty Char and at school, I was literally, and I was at the music service as well, so I rehearsed, I think, 4 days a week at school, two rehearsals with you, and then Friday nights with music service and two bands on a Saturday with music service. So I was literally in about between six and eight bands a week.
Yeah, I can...
Didn't practice much, only when I had a grade coming up.
Yeah.
And that's how we got better, by playing in bands. And that's what's sad about now, is that that's not available as much now. I mean, those bands I've just mentioned are all still going, but there's not as many kids coming in to do it. But getting back to the talent thing, you think there is an element of, other than perfect pitch, which given obviously perfect pitch is a natural ability. But that can also be a crutch, a handicap in a way, because I remember teaching John Escreet, who's got perfect pitch, excellent, amazing, world-class jazz pianist who's also come through your ranks. And I remember he started playing saxophone when he was probably about 13 or 14. And I think he played French horn as well. And I was teaching him, and he really was struggling to read music because he was reading a B flat part because he was on tenor.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he was reading, I don't know, a D, playing a D, and he's thinking, that's not a D, because he's got perfect pitch. He's like, that's a C. And it really messed with his head. So he could argue that perfect pitch isn't, I mean, it is a natural gift without a doubt, but it might not always be beneficial. If you're playing by ear, brilliant. If you're reading, it might be the last thing you need.
Yeah, I can accept that explanation, because it can be a hang-up, I think, for some in that situation. But I still have to hang in there and say that I don't even meet you halfway on this this discussion, which I think we partly had ad nauseum for some years now. But there are some that there are able to show their talent, whether they've worked hard for it or not.
But that's the thing. I don't think that you can play an instrument well without working hard.
Yeah.
Even if there is such a thing as a natural gift, you still got to put the hours in.
No, no.
I think. I've taught a lot of people one-to-one. You taught groups, obviously, and one-to-one. And you've led bands and ensembles through rehearsals and albums and tours. My teaching is literally been like me and someone else.
Mm.
But of all the people that I've taught that have just gone like that, they've all practiced a lot. I know they have, because they've told me, the parents have told me, you know, you can hear it. And I don't think I've ever taught someone that didn't practice and got really good. But if they had a natural gift, then shouldn't that equate to them still getting good without doing much practice?
Or shouldn't equate to them sort of having the desire to practice? So they're, you know, that gift that they have is actually telling them things. I mean, it must be strange for someone that's got perfect pitch. And I wonder what goes on in those minds when they're nowhere near a musical instrument or something like that.
That's what I mean. You could probably...
When did they find out that they had that?
Oh, I don't know. Mm. You're asking the wrong person.
No.
Well, I'm still working on my relative pitch. Never mind perfect pitch. I don't know. I think it's probably just one of those moments where you just... Well, maybe probably the first time you sit at an instrument, whatever it is, and someone says, that's a such and such, and you make that, you know, that equation then. I don't know. I have to ask John Escree.
You know, it's you were talking about the way the situation is now. I mean, we've talked about the sort of band, and I've talked about the halcyon days of, through the 70s and 80s, 90s, and to the present day, that there's always, I've been pleased to say, and look in that respect, that there's always been that interest, a group of people sort of coming through and wanting to audition. We've never been too pleased ever on auditioning individuals.
Mm.
We'd rather see them in a group and in a situation and in a working situation. Then you find out a little bit more about the individuals that way as well. Mm. But all of this, the other thing I must point out is that all of the stuff that we've done historically with the Jazz Association, I have always been fortunate enough to have a team of people working with me. It is not a one-man, one-person show, because that is such an important part. It's not just something that I say. It's something that I mean, because it couldn't work any other way.
Well, I can attest to that, because, you know, to some level, certainly our family is part of that team, but there is a lot more people. And I've witnessed it since being a kid. Like, there's always been a handful of people around you willing to help to do all the ugly stuff, if you like, while you get to do, you know, the pretty stuff
all in front
of the band.
Yeah.
And no, I know, and you're always keen to emphasise this point, and that I think that's great, because it's first of all, it's true. Yeah, it is true. And second of all, they're the people that don't get the accolades and the, you know, they're not there on the stage at the end of the concert bowing and stuff like that. But I think, you know, that's been part, like you say, that's part of the success of Die Jar is there's been all these people and still are helping out, doing the, whether it's setting up gear or making cups of tea or, you know, driving a bus or providing a van
or being a volunteer member as a director or a committee member or a board member.
Yeah.
which that has been.
It has been a massive team effort, and still is. Mm-hmm. And it's that, you know, you can't overemphasize it, but it is important that you do emphasize that all the time, because it, you know, some people, you know, some people, it was there. It was probably as important to them as it has been to you. I can think of a few people who gave everything, mm-hmm. you know, for Diyajar.
Definitely.
And still do. Yeah. So you're right. It's not just down to yourself and the kids.
Phil and Marion Gibbons come to mind. Ron Kettley, who was a legend in his own lifetime.
Yeah.
And
There's loads of people. Again, it would be, you know, we'd probably forget people if we started listing lots of names. But even to this day, it's, you know, Diyajar's still going very much, albeit not in the centre anymore. But there's still people there doing exactly what we've just been talking about.
And those people are even more vital now because of the atmosphere in which we work. I mean, the society, certainly in terms of music education.
Yeah.
Because it's getting more difficult. You touched on it earlier on. I mean, some of our youngsters are having to, you know, do a risk assessment to leave the house to come to rehearsal.
It's sad.
That's a bad joke, I know, but but I know that it's necessary. But
it's just a shame, isn't it?
Puts everything on because,
I mean, when you think about, you know, when
you mentioned the buses that you were getting,
that's what I was just about to say. I mean, you know, back in probably the late 70s when you first went to Nice or wherever it is, did you go to Nice Jazz Festival or whatever?
Yeah,
you probably just rented a bus, it rocked up at some place, and everyone had a bag, and their mums and dads waved them off, and off you got. You know, you went on a bus, and you know, probably some kids misbehaved and got up with some stuff that you shouldn't have done, like we all did at that age.
Never,
but but nothing bad ever happened. You know, everyone came back in one piece, you know, with stories to tell and memories for life and friends for life as well. Mm. And now it's like you say, just to even do a simple thing, like even just to rehearse now is difficult.
Mm, yeah.
And it's such a shame. No, like, as a dad to a young child, it worries me that you know, your grandkids are not going to get the same opportunities that I had, because it's not being facilitated. It's there. Diyajar's there. Mm-hmm. Music service is there. The concert band is there, you know, but the kids aren't coming through because the society we live in, and we live in a society now where there's, you know, there's gadgets and everyone wants everything immediately. And I think kids are losing that ability to stick at something that's difficult, which is what playing a music instrument involves. Mm-hmm. You know, they're busy off doing so many things now that music seems to be falling by the wayside. It is a shame. And I think you could probably say the same for sport as well. The arts and sport, I think, are probably not where they were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
I think you're right in that respect. But no, all that you sort of said about the exchanges and the trips abroad, you know, whether it be France, Germany or America, which we were fortunate enough to go, and of course Russia.
Russia.
Our trips there, all of those things. And of course, Russia at that time. Well, it was the
that's the story.
The USSR at that
time. We need to talk about that.
Maybe we shouldn't, because it's just, even now that you mentioned stories earlier on that are coming back. You all remember these stories, the exchanges.
Yeah,
I'm only getting to hear some of them now, because these people that we're talking about, they're now in their mid 40s to mid 50s to mid 60s in some cases, and they're saying, "Oh, John, you didn't know, but I must tell you that when we were in Nice,"
there's loads of
another story.
There's loads of stuff I did on trips that you probably don't know. You definitely don't know about. But that's part of growing up, isn't it?
Character building.
The Russia thing. When you think about that, we'll talk about that in a different episode, because that was sketchy.
That was sketchy, and there was a great relief from myself and Mr. Ron Kettley when we got back onto our own soil.
Yeah.
But great experience was there. But when we look back, there were 40 of them. I'm really quite pleased that I did turn down a trip whilst we were there to Odessa by train.
Was that on the cards, was it?
And that was on the cards. And we found out afterwards it was not the nicest train or journey to go on.
Yeah, well, and that whole trip was a great trip. I was 15 when we did that.
Yeah.
And it was still Soviet Russia, wasn't it? Or it just, was it just opened up? It was after the wall came down, was it?
Good Lord, I'm not sure now. I think it was.
What was it,
90?
Yeah, and the wall came down in 89. Mm-hmm. I think it was just about to open up, hence why they were inviting Western bands over there.
Mr. Gorbachev was... was there, bless him.
That was a very, very interesting trip. I think we'll leave it there because...
You wouldn't like to go there now then? No.
Maybe, yeah. I'd go there now. But I probably wouldn't go there with a load of 15-year-old musicians.
I don't think I'd like to go with you lot, to be honest. I don't think them.
We probably won't make it back now. Mm-mm. Anyway, I need a coffee. So I think we'll wrap it up and... next time I see you, we'll talk about something else.
Okay, well, thanks ever so much. Thanks for your interest. And
thanks for your interest. It's not a job interview, I
know. No, just want to let you know that this is... This is the longest conversation I've had with my son in years. I think I'm going to go for a lie down.
Possibly.
All right. Cheers.
And it's not involved discussing set lists and what we're going to wear. And
probably not, no.
Stuff like that.
No.
It's been good though. I'll see you again.
Good. I just Yes, it's been good. I'll see you again sometime. Take care. All the best.
I'll get my people to call your people. We'll figure something out.
Oh, please do. Right. Yeah, I look forward to it.
Cool. See ya.
Cheers, bye.